Nurses and Hypochondriacs, the podcast that brings nurse experts, patients, and hypochondriacs together to discuss hot topics in healthcare. And here is your host, Ercilia Pompilio.
We are episode number 10. This is awesome. Great. Thank you so much for everybody who's been listening. You guys are awesome. I love the comments. Thank you so much. I got a comment from a woman the other day who listened to our Valley Fever podcast, and she said it scared her. Yeah, it should be scary. Getting Valley Fever and cocci in your lungs is pretty scary. Another thing that's been scary this week is I had a birthday on Monday, March 5th, and I turned 45. Woo-hoo. That's not the scary thing. My guest is woo-hooing me. That's not the scary thing. The scary thing is people have been calling me ma'am. Ma'am, hello. I mean, I don't know. It never occurred to me before I was 45, but everywhere I go now, people are like, thank you, ma'am. See you later, ma'am. Don't forget your stuff on the table, ma'am. And I'm like, that's so weird. I mean, I went to a bar a few years ago, and the guy at the door, he asked me for my ID. I gave him my ID. He's like, or he said first, he's like, can I see your ID, miss? That's how it happened. He goes, can I see your ID, miss? And I was like, sure. And I give him my ID. And as soon as he looks at my ID and he looks at me, gives me back my ID, he goes, thank you, ma'am. It's like I literally aged in 2 seconds. I mean, it went from this sweet, thank you, you know, can I see your ID, miss, to thank you, ma'am. It's like, hello, his voice even changed. It's crazy. But anyway, being 45 is cool. I love my age. I'm happy. I've never lied about my age. Another crazy thing that happened to me this week is I got into a fight with a physician. Not what you would think normally. You know, it's kind of loud today. I'm in a coffee shop here in Palm Springs. That's where I'm broadcasting from. But anyway, I got in a fight with this physician. I was at a dinner, and it was an opioids dinner, and it's not what it sounds like. It's like you're not eating opioids. You're not eating oxycodone. They're talking about alternatives to using opioids for patients. And it was put on by Desert Pain Institute here in Palm Springs. And that's where I'm broadcasting from today, Palm Springs. They had the dinner at the very posh 849. Very nice. So I got there a little bit late, and I sat next to this physician who looked like he weighed 350 pounds. I mean, he looked like Octomom. He was about to give birth. That's how big his belly was. And he was complaining that he could not give his opioid-addicted patients codeine for their cough. So he was like, I don't know what to give them. Their coughs are so bad, and I can't give them codeine. Like, that's the only cough medicine there is out there. And I was like, hey, why don't you tell them to make some ginger tea? And he goes, what? Like that. He starts screaming at me in across the table. He's like, ginger tea? What does that do? There's no peer-reviewed literature about that. And I was like, yes, there is. You know, I've used it myself. I use it on my family. My patients use it. You know, it works. It works to get rid of that mucus in your lungs. And he's like, where do you get that from? And I'm like, the supermarket. It costs $1. And he's like, you're a quack. And he starts screaming at me from across the table that I was a quack. And I'm like, so I start quacking like a duck. And I'm like, quack, quack, quack. I mean, he was eating duck. That was the funniest thing. You know, that was one of the meals. And I felt bad. So I tried to shut that down. I was like, you know, okay, you just stop. We're at this dinner. There's literally like 40 people here. It's at a nice place. The lecturer, Dr. Tim, who is from the Desert Pain Institute, he was talking about like spinal stuff that you could do instead of giving opioids. And he was just watching it, and I felt bad because I was taking away from his presentation. So he went back to his presentation after we stopped the argument. And after the dinner, I went up to Dr. Tim, and I said, you know, I'm really sorry about that. That was out of control. He's like, that was so cool. That was so cool. You were into it. He goes, oh, my gosh, that was awesome. He goes, yes, we do treat at our clinic. We have a naturopath and you are so on it. Oh my God, that was great. That was exciting, that fight. And so I guess it just added to the lecture. You know, that's me. I'm always there for your comedic entertainment. What can I say? So that being said, we'll just jump into our episode today. And I'd like to open it up with this clip.
Wayne, what do you do if every time you see this one incredible woman, you think you're gonna hurl?
I say hurl. If you blow chunks and she comes back, she's yours. If you spew and she bolts, it was never meant to be.
Oh, I'm not ready yet. I gotta be comfortable with me first.
Why don't you just go talk to her? Talk to her. Talk to her. Talk to her.
And that is from Wayne's World. Can you believe Wayne's World is 1992? 1992, it's so old. Like, I graduated from high school in 1991. Oh, so funny how time flies. But anyway, our episode number 10 today is on teens and porn addiction. And I'm excited to bring on my guest. His name is Braxton Dudson. He is a licensed clinical social worker and sex therapist. He specializes in out-of-control sexual behavior in teens and adults. Braxton practices at the Healing Group in Salt Lake City, Utah, and is the host of Sexual Health Education Podcast, Birds and Bees Podcast. His primary goal is to support couples and parents in having discussions about sexuality with each other and with their children to decrease shame around sex and improve sexual health overall. Welcome to the podcast, Braxton.
Thank you for having me, Ursula. I'm glad to be here.
Well, cool. So how did you get into being a sex therapist and a clinical social worker?
So it's kind of an interesting go about. So I started here in Utah County and in Salt Lake City working, volunteering for a rape recovery center. And I wanted to work with survivors of sexual assault and sexual abuse. And in my master's degree, I ended up taking a human sexuality class and was like, whoa, there's a lot more to sex and sexual health than just healing from sexual abuse and sexual shame. And from there, as I went in, I've been taking a lot of trainings across the United States, and once I went to a couple of these trainings, I started realizing there was a lot more issues in out of control sexual behavior that I tend to work really well with. So I've been working with teens since I was in my bachelor's level in 2011. So it's been like 6 years that I've been working with teenagers, and I noticed that there was a lot of sexual interest as well as discussion on what is normal sexual health, and it fascinated me. So from there, I continued studying it and working with these teens and parents, and kind of led me to where I'm at right now.
That's pretty awesome. And being a podcast is great. You know, I think now is like really we're at the height of the podcast generation for education, and it's so, I mean, I don't know. It's the time right now, and I think it's a great educational tool. And I hear you with that. And right now, like this whole porn addiction thing, I mean, I've been reading so many articles just written this year. You know, I think you sent me one. I pulled a couple of other ones. And there's so much research being done in this area, which I think is fascinating. I mean, I'm going to tell you a little story about what happened to me and how I got interested in this subject. I was dating someone who I met off of Tinder, and I invited him to the Magic Castle in Hollywood. I have a magician friend who kept, you know, asking me to come to the Magic Castle. He's like, when are you going to come to the Magic Castle? And he's Russian. And I was like, yeah, you know, so I had been chatting with this guy online. He seemed pretty nice. And I was like, have you ever been to the Magic Castle? He said, no. And I wanted to go with someone who had never experienced Magic Castle as myself. And so we met there, we went together, and it was great. And we started dating, and things got a little bit intimate. I noticed something was just off. You know, there was no connection happening during sexual intimacy. And I thought it was just weird. Like, I felt something was wrong with my brain. I was like, I don't know. I like this guy, but there's this disconnect, and I don't understand why, because he treated me so well after, you know, outside of that sexual intimacy. He was cooking for me, you know, was taking me places. He was being very, very sweet, but then something was just off. It didn't feel genuine. Like, even the outside of the bedroom. So I took a break from the relationship probably about a week, and I went home, and I was just like, something's off. And for some reason, porn addiction popped into my head, and I started doing all this research, and I started, you know, looking through all these articles very frantically. And I'm a pediatric nurse practitioner. Nurse practitioners are very evidence-based, so we're taught to go to the research and look at stuff. So I pull all this stuff. I call up the guy, and he kind of didn't want to see me. He was a little bit feeling depressed and not seeing people. He was being very, he was just going through this depressive mode. So I went to go see him, and we were having wine, and I just didn't know how to breach the subject with him. And he just seemed out of it, you know. And we ended up, he ended up first saying, hey, listen, you know, I don't think this relationship is working out, and I'm wanting to break up with you. And I was like, that's fine. I go, but I have a question to ask you first. And it might seem a little bit forward, but are you addicted to porn? And he gave me the weirdest look. And, you know, I just decided to take a chance and go for it and see if my intuition was right on and my research was right on. And he kind of looked at me really weird. And I said, hey, listen, you can tell me about these things. I'm a pediatric nurse practitioner. I talk to, you know, kids about sex all the time. I have to be very open. I took two semesters of the psychology of sex in undergrad, and my hairdresser was nominated for an Emmy for Masters of Sex. So I'm technically a sex expert. So you can open up and talk to me. So he did. And he came out, and it was just like all this diary of mouth about what was going on with him. And he ended up getting addicted to porn because he was hotels, because he traveled a lot for work. So he started, it ended his first marriage. That was one of the factors that he said, and he didn't know how to stop. And it was really scary. And and so he, like, we didn't talk for a few weeks, and then he followed up with me. He's like, oh yeah, I went to go see a therapist, and it's much better now. And he felt there was, you know, at least there was a name to what was going on with him. He was getting treatment. He was a cure, that he didn't have to be in this little box. And he said that he was really isolating himself from his friends. He was no longer talking to any of his friends, his family. But then after he was getting therapy, he out of that isolation mode, so which was very, very interesting. But so that's my story.
That is an interesting story when it comes to pornography and things like that. The things that pop out to me, especially as you're talking about that, is one of the things that I've been noticing as time's gone on is that that sex and pornography addiction is kind of a word that's been interestingly thrown around a lot more than it's kind of become a pop culture term. Because you and I, we could be sitting here and I could say that
or porn addiction, are you saying?
Yeah, we could say that so with porn addiction, being able to say that someone's a porn addict, we don't have any type of diagnostic criteria for it. So it becomes very subjective. So when I work with teenagers and parents and adults, many times, I mean, the majority of the time when I meet with someone, they're coming in because of something I feel out of control with. And the interesting part is that I have a lot of people come in and say, "Hey, I'm addicted to porn." And my follow-up question with that is, what does that mean to you? Because I've worked with people that say they're addicted to porn, that watch porn once every 6 months for about 15 minutes. And some, that means to them that it's watching pornography 3 or 4 times a week. And I've had people that watch it every day that say, "I don't have a problem with it." So it's all very, very subjective to who we're talking to and who's discussing what's disturbing to them or what's causing distress. So if someone's religious, say here in Utah where we've got a high population of Latter-day Saint or Mormon community, it's taught quite frequently that any type of pornography use is problematic. And so people are more likely to say that they're addicted to pornography. When we don't really understand if what that means. Does that mean a couple times a week? Does that mean they really can't stop? And most of the time what I've ended up finding out is that if there is an issue they're dealing with, like in this situation with your story that you're telling, is that it sounds like he had some depressive symptoms as well as he was dealing with a lot of other things. And so it's really hard to bring up that pornography or sex or anything that they're using is the coping skill, or is the, whether they're coping or whether they're there's a causation behind it. Did they watch porn and now they're depressed? Or are they experiencing depressing symptoms?
He didn't say he was coping with. That's how he was able to.
Okay. So he was coping.
Well, he did say, I remember from my story, he was coping with it. So that was his coping mechanism with everything.
Yeah. It sounds like he was using pornography.
The more stress he had in his life, the more porn.
Yeah. Yeah. A lot of the times the pornography, it sounds like he was using isolation. And a couple other things to be able to deal with the sadness or the symptoms he was facing. And so it can be really easy for us to say, "Oh, look, the dude's addicted to pornography. Obviously he's depressed. He needs some support to get off of this porn addiction." And we're quick to blame pornography. And again, I'm not here to
right,
like, protect pornography. I mean, I just know that it's becoming we're overlooking bigger symptoms because it's an easier scapegoat. So I'm not here to say, well, we need to keep pornography or we need to, you know, there's no harm in it. No, I'm not saying that at all. But I do want to challenge people to look deeper and say, what is actually going on? and so that's kind of how
I agree with you on that one. So going back to Utah, I have a friend who is a storyteller and he used to teach Bible classes, and he told me that there is a huge porn addiction culture in Utah. Is that correct?
The wording, like I was saying,
for people that are addicted to porn, I should say.
Yeah, well, is the wording that's used, as well as what was it? I think it was 2 sessions ago that Utah came out with pornography as a public health crisis. And there's a lot of people that are saying that Utah is one of the highest.
Oh, wow. Interesting.
Yeah. A couple of years ago, Senator Todd Weiler put out a bill that put pornography as a public health crisis. And there's been some other states that have followed suit with that. And the interesting thing is it seems more like a bill that's like, all right, we're going to stand against it. But I don't know that I haven't seen much of the fight back. It's a public health crisis. Okay, we're naming it that. So what are we going to do about it? And we don't have much to do about it besides send people to 12-step programs. And in reality, what I've found is that education is one of the best ways to work against pornography exposure to kids as well as to adults. And we're not giving that education.
Right. So you're saying that the only thing to do now really is what they have is to send people to 12-step programs, right? Is that correct? And 12-step programs that alcoholics will go to, or people who are abusing drugs or drugs and alcohol,
That's the most common referred one here in Utah, at least. I can only speak from here in Utah. It's real interesting. You can go to other states and search up sex addiction, and you know, you might come up with one or two programs. But in Utah, we have a ton of. I mean, everyone throws in these 12-step programs and different sex addiction programs you can go through, almost like if you're an alcoholic, because we're calling it addiction. And we're not seeing any type of huge change from going to a 12-step program versus regular psychotherapy. And there's a lot of people that seem to be taken advantage of. The thing that I found is that wording it in the sense of, I use out of control sexual behavior because a lot of people, I recognize they're coming in distressed. And they're saying, I want to change something about my pornography use or about how I interact with someone sexually, or I want to change my behavior. And in doing so, we can work with feeling out of control. I'm not to discredit that, but labeling someone that they're an addict puts them into a whole different realm of, oh, well, we can blame the addiction and not look any farther into what's uncomfortable. The thing that I found for myself, one of the things that I do is I use the three C's of why we look at pornography or why kids look at pornography. And I found that when the three C's are called clicking, curious, and coping. So the first one, clicking, is essentially we got kids that are being exposed to pornography roughly around the age of 8. There's a couple different research studies that varies. I've heard it vary from 8 to 10, but early being about 8 years old.
That's about right, because at 8 is when you are supposed to be teaching a child about sexuality. I mean, as nurse practitioners, we really encourage parents to start talking about the human anatomy, because that's when kids are starting to go into puberty much earlier now, like usually 9 and 10. And so we like to start the discussions at that age. So I'm really not surprised that that's when kids are seeking.
Yeah. And I would say that the earlier that you can start having these conversations, the more prepared parents are going to be. And we'll talk about that a little bit later as well, about how parents can improve their ability to help avoid pornography or help their kids avoid pornography. And one of that is starting early, you know, calling a vulva a vulva, calling a penis, using these terms, letting it become a common discussion versus, all right, you're 8 years old, now we're going to have the talk. And then you're 12, and now we're going to have the puberty talk.
Yeah, exactly.
Now we're going to have a more in detailed sex talk, but having a conversation constantly while they're growing up. But going back to the 8 years old, so they're exposed. It's quite frequent that people are exposed to, or these kids are exposed to pornography in some form or another around the age of 8. And a lot of that tends to be, or seems to me that it ends up being, by clicking, kind of by accident. One girl, she was typing in, trying to find and search for tights on the internet, and spelled it T-I-T-S. And obviously, if you're typing in tits, you're going to get, Google's going to send you what you want. So it was accidental. She was clicking through. It's not uncommon for kids to misspell words, look on something, be going through YouTube, and be exposed to something that's sexually related in nature. The next one is curiosity. That's where we start getting into, if we're not talking about it and someone hears a word, is curious about what the other person's body looks like, and we start researching, what does a girl's body look like? What does a boy's body look like? It's quite easy for them to come across images, videos of pornographic material. And the third one is coping. So I found that what we've talked about a little bit is that as symptoms come up, when teenagers are having distressing times in school, in any point in time of their life, if they're distressed, pornography, masturbation go hand in hand, and they tend to use that as a coping skill. So family members being divorced, issues within.
Yeah, because it's kind of, it's a release for them.
Yeah. Yeah, very much so. And we don't teach men very, we don't teach boys, young boys, very many ways to cope with their feelings because they're supposed to keep them inside. And so a lot of the times we see a lot of pornography and masturbation take that role in anger. And so parents being able to recognize, and it's a way that I teach parents to assess a little bit where their child's at, because if I've got a 9-year-old that's coming in and they're saying my child's addicted to pornography, these are some of the first questions that I go over is what happened? Because a lot of the times it's an accidental exposure. They're being curious, but maybe they're coping. But I found that under those three groups, we can find out what support your child needs. And if they're coping, therapeutic support is really helpful. We can find different coping skills. We can process issues that are happening, and they can get the support that they need versus stop looking at pornography.
Right. And you could give them tools and stuff as well.
100%.
Right. So how did you learn personally about sex? Were your parents very open with you?
So my parents, my mom was really open about sexuality. So I remember, I think I got that 8-year-old talk actually.
Oh, did you?
Yeah. So I remember I was watching Touched by an Angel, ironically. And after Touched by an Angel, we...
okay, so you were watching Touched by an Angel, you were saying?
Yeah, so we were watching Touched by an Angel, and the teenagers went to an arcade, which was a motel, and I was super confused. I was like, well, an arcade's not a bad thing. Why are they freaking out? And my mom took me downstairs, and she'd been using anatomically correct terms. So she's like, you know, your penis goes inside a female's vagina, and that's sex. And that's how babies are made. And, you know, kind of went over all of the sexual terms with me. And I was like, oh, okay. It was kind of a big thing I wasn't prepared for, but they talked to me about it. And from there on out, we had smaller conversations. I didn't talk too much about it with my dad, I was taught about my body quite frequently by my mom. But there were some things that we didn't talk about. I didn't learn too much about the female anatomy until I was in my teens. But I felt comfortable talking to my mom about it. So when I was like, Mom, what's up with this menstruation or period stuff? And she was like, this is what's going on. and she taught me, if you ever see a girl that starts to bleed in class, don't approach her. You go talk to a teacher. Don't tell anybody else. And I mean, that happened a couple times in junior high. And I was like, oh man, sweet. I know what to do in this situation. Go grab a teacher. Hey, it looks like so-and-so started her period and doesn't know it. And we were able to non-shame a body function. And so I felt pretty special on that occasion.
That's a cool story. I mean, yeah, in my practice now, it's interesting on how many parents don't educate their children about sex, or they feel uncomfortable, or they don't know how to approach it. And they were to school here, they were born here. My parents were from Italy, so I was brought up by immigrant parents, and I had to learn about sex on my own, and I would check out books from the library, and I mentioned this in my last podcast that we did on sex. And yeah, I learned from Judy Blume, you know, and from watching HBO movies that were kind of like scraggled. You couldn't really see the body parts, but you could see people being intimate on people who had HBO. We never had cable. It was always very, very interesting to me. And to this day, when I ask my patients about it or their families, you know, it's still like an uncomfortable topic. And I think this is why we're having so many problems. because people are not being open with their children about sexuality or open about sexuality with their partners. So mm-hmm. this is why it's still a taboo thing, and it's 2018, which is so bizarre to me. You know, and so like I said, but now we're starting the conversations, because like I said, after my story that happened last year, because I was dating that individual last year, I went to our nurse practitioner conference, and it happened to be in Denver. And so I did a storytelling show there as well, and I had told the same story that I just told here about the individual who I was dating. And I remember telling my Lyft driver this story about porn addiction. He's like, oh, I better watch my porn intake then, you know? And I had told my friends, and they were being very open about issues that they were having. And one in particular, my friend's son, his mood had changed, she noticed, and she didn't understand why until she looked in his computer and noticed that he was watching porn. And so she just, you know, she's college educated and stuff. And she told him to stop watching porn or the devil was going to get him.
Oh, no.
And I was like, why did you tell him that? And she's like, I didn't know what to do. And I felt like terrible. I was like, that's not, you know, she's like, well, that's, and she's like, but he stopped. And I go, I hear you, but, you know, there has to be another way. And so you had sent me that article as well from the New York from the New York Times that just came out in February. That was really great.
Well, and I want to address really quick what you said there, because she said that it stopped. And what I see happening there is, first off, the devil's going to get you. So she finds out. He then feels shame, and he's like, oh no, I was just caught. Oh, and now the devil's going to get me, which, I mean, we can laugh at, you know, it's like, oh, but right. You know, the devil's going to get you. But at the same time, for a child, for a teenager to see that, that creates a ton of shame.
Right, exactly.
And the shame drives secrecy. So whether that, my thought is more, he got ultimately either he may have stopped completely. I mean, that is a possibility. The majority of what I see is that it goes more secretive. And in order to be able to make it so that we don't get that shame feeling anymore. One of the things that I tell parents, there's a sex therapist here in Utah that I was talking with her about the three C's. She came up with the three C's of how parents can respond. And I want to preface this with, it doesn't matter if you've told your child that the devil's going to get him for porn, that is okay that you responded in that way. We can always redo. We can always have a redo. And it's important that we have a redo. So even your friend in that moment, even though this has gone on for a little bit, and maybe it's in the past, she can redo it. And I tell him, or Kristen Hodson talks about keeping calm, keeping curious, and keeping connected. So the three C's of parenting. When you find out your child's been or looking at pornography or been exposed to pornography, because if you can stay calm and deal with what your own reactions are of like, oh my goodness, my son, my daughter is being exposed to pornography. What does that mean? What does that mean to me about being a parent? Staying calm helps avoid the shame, helps keep that away. If you can remain curious, you find so much more information from your child. What was it that you saw? What did you think about what you saw?
Exactly.
Are you curious about that? Like what is going on? It invites conversation versus secrecy, which is another way to dispel some shame. And you can find out if they're dealing with a hard time or if they're just curious or if it was an accident. There's a lot that curiosity can help with parents. And then you want to keep the connection. If you're not connected with your child, if there is pulling away and pushing to be like, I don't want to deal with my child looking at pornography, so just don't let me see it. If you're not connected with your child, they're either going to see pornography, they're going to ask someone else, they're going to look to Google. The more that you can remain in those three states, the better you're going to be able to help your child avoid shame and get them the help they need if they run into pornography, whether that's education, whether that's support, whether that's a conversation about what they saw. You can be the one, and we want you as a parent to be the one there. And that's a huge reason why I started this Birds and Bees podcast, because what I found, what you were saying earlier too, is that parents feel like they're so inadequate in that moment. And they don't feel like they've got the education to be able to talk to their kids or talk to each other about sex. So they avoid it. They don't talk about it because the generation before them hadn't been talking about it. And it's time for us to start having these uncomfortable conversations. My goal is to be able to let parents and couples know correct sexual health and be able to help them say, yeah, I can be one chapter ahead of this person, of my child, and I can learn how to talk about all these different issues. I don't have to do it alone.
I agree with that. And once again, going back to just being just very open and not judging, you know, the child's experience and stuff.
Yeah.
Just having them explain it and everything. Which I just want to go over the New York Times article, February 8th, 2018. Like I said, there's at least two or three articles that I've read lately that are pretty current from this year. And it's about how this kid Drew, he was 8 years old, and how he started getting really into watching porn. He was just flipping through TV channels. He'd seen Girls Gone Wild. He then came across HBO's late night softcore porn. Then in ninth grade, he found online porn sites. And the videos were good for getting off, he said, and also sources for ideas for future sex positions with future girlfriends. Mm-hmm. And from porn, he learned that guys need to be buff and dominant in bed, doing things like flipping girls over on their stomachs during sex. So here's the thing with these teenagers in this generation now, that they are learning from porn and stuff. It's just this whole paradigm is shifting about what sexuality is really about. And, you know, instead of being connected, and instead of sexuality being for procreation, really, and starting a family, it's kind of changed. It's more, and I don't know, like in this article, it was saying that these boys are visualizing more like, oh, yeah, anal, because the female loves anal, or you have to be very aggressive, and because women like that. And so it's rather disturbing to me what these teens are saying. Are you finding this in your practice with teens that you're talking to, that this is what their perception of what sex really is now?
It's a really good question. Especially because what I'm seeing is that, again, we're talking about pornography being an issue. And yes, this is where teens need the education the most, because everyone needs to know that porn is not a documentary. Watching pornography.
It's fiction.
Huh?
It's pure fiction and fantasy.
Yeah, it is. And I tell parents this all the time when they come and talk to me. I said, you know what? We don't teach teens how to drive by saying, okay, sit down, let's watch the Fast and Furious 7 video.
Exactly. That's a really good point.
Yeah, because we don't. And they've been riding in cars. They've been talked about cars. They may have even worked on cars growing up. They're associated with it a little bit better. They understand that mom's Civic is not going to do what the Dodge Charger does on Fast and Furious. There's context there. And in pornography and sex, we're not having conversations about sex. We're not educating about sex, because the majority of the schools only teach abstinence only, and so there's very minimal sex education. And then we expect them to be like, okay, we're going to, you know, you're going to have questions about these things, but we can't talk about what a blowjob is. We can't talk about healthy relationships. We can't talk about STIs, because that's scary and maybe you'll have it later. And ultimately, it's just like teaching them that, this is the Fast and Furious. You can drive a car like this. But they need to know that, sure, some people enjoy going fast and burning their tires and doing everything that happens in Fast and Furious. But they also need to understand the consequences. In Fast and Furious 7, if they're roasting their tires all the time, you're going to spend thousands of dollars in tires. and you have to keep up in maintenance and everything. It's the same with sex. You need to know that a lot of people don't enjoy these positions.
That's a good point.
The camera angles are definitely in a space to be more exposed. And so a lot of people aren't going to be, again, it's not a documentary. And the majority of the time, they don't show the things in pornography that aren't sexy. Talking about, hey, can I do this? Hey, let's put lube on. Hey, would you, is it all right if I twist your nipples like this while we're on camera? They don't talk about, they don't show any of the non-sexy things. And the hugging, the all sort, whatever is going on there. And they don't talk about being able to connect and show pleasure. And it's all about just everyone's receiving pleasure all the time, no matter what's happening.
Well, I think they're putting pleasure and pain together, you know.
And they can, depending on the pornography that we're watching. And that's another issue that we run into as well, is that when we talk about pornography, I've got in my head what pornography looks like. You've got in your head what pornography looks like and what is deemed pornographic. And so, again, we really come back to what's subjective when it's not. But if we're talking about hardcore pornography, which is kind of what I'm referring to, you get these teenagers that all they've got is, what's a blowjob? Oh, that's what a blowjob looks like. It looks like, you know, this is what the girl is, and this is how sex works. We go oral sex, and then we do all these other things, and she's supposed to be having this minor orgasm into a major orgasm the entire time, and I'm supposed to last for 15 minutes, 20 minutes, 45 minutes. And be really hard, and this is how big my penis should be, and this is how she should be reacting, and this is how a woman's body looks. So they're getting the sex education from pornography, and it's not correct information. So yeah, we need to address that. The thing that I thought was great in that article is that towards the end, the more information that they gave them, the more they were like, oh, maybe I need to ask if I want to try anal. Maybe I need to ask if she's
experiencing consent.
Yeah,
which is huge right now.
Completely.
And this is what the big conversation is all about with the Me Too movement and everything.
Yeah,
which is very interesting. I think that's great. I just want to go back to just pornography on the brain. I do have some studies here on how it does change the neurotransmitters. I mean, I know we were talking about earlier how it's a little bit different than let's say drug and alcohol addiction. But my research that I pulled, it shows that it changes the neurotransmitters in the brain. You know, when people are watching porn, it is stimulating it's stimulating more oxytocin in the brain. It's stimulating, I'm going to grab that article. It's stimulating more dopamine, you know? Uh-huh. So it's like that drug, like you will then need harder and harder for porn in order to get that same amount of dopamine boost into your brain. They even did a study here that I have, which is really, I think, funny. But they went ahead and showed, study is this, it was in JAMA Psychiatry. So they showed these Mackay monkeys porn. So the porn that they showed the Mackay monkeys was of female monkey bottoms. Okay. So they noticed that the monkeys would give up the reward, which was juice, in order to watch more of these female monkey bottoms.
Wow.
It's monkey porn.
Monkey porn.
Which was very interesting, you know, I think. So,
yeah, pornography, sex in of itself is, you know, gives us the good feeling, and pornography is going to stimulate those same things, and the brain does change. I am 100% with that. And the same with like the neural pathways and things like that, just as much as our eating habits or drinking a Coke, things that give us pleasure. Again,
it's
I'm
true.
Not necessarily saying pornography. Yeah. But having all those, so we get into patterns as humans that, yeah, I mean, if we're going to pornography and it's like, oh, this is what we're going to do, we're going to get into a space of, when I'm feeling distressed, I'm going to jump onto pornography because, There is, everyone's ready to have sex when I want to have sex. I get to touch myself the way I'd like to. I get to see and experience exactly what I want to. And there's no emotional exposure. It's you and your computer screen or whatever you're using.
Right.
And so it becomes quite an easy way for individuals to be like, yes, this is the way that I can deal with distress. And a lot of as I'm working with teenagers and adults, it's reintroducing or going through different coping skills and using those coping skills instead of kind of think of it as a superhighway when we're using just pornography and masturbation to deal with distress. We have to relearn. And that's the beautiful part about brains is the brain continues to relearn and we can create new neural right. pathways.
Exactly. And that is it, the neuroplasticity of the brain. And that is what's so great. And that's when people can heal and kind of say, okay, well, I went through that experience, you know, and it could have been a dark space. It could have been a learning experience, but now I know how to do better and have better relationships with people.
Very much so.
It's not only porn, which I think you're bringing up a good point, but it's also the media, you know, and I am very media based and on how the media affects our teens, how the media affects our culture as a growing population. And, you know, there's shows like The Family Guy, which is always referencing like choking and anal sex. And I don't know how that's on regular TV, you know, it really should be on cable. But like, and then we have our music people like Nicki Minaj, and she's always talking about like anal sex and vaginal sex as well. And Rihanna is talking about S&M. And then there's movies like 50 Shades of Grey, Mr. and Mrs. Smith, where it's really aggressive. And I think in the New York Times article, it had referenced a few of these things as well, as these kids going, well, look, it's all around us in the media, so this is okay, and this is what we should mirror and mimic, and this is what we should be doing, you know?
Yeah.
And there's also the romantic comedies as well. And not only that, there's companies that are marketing porn, like Comcast, YouTube, Intercontinental Hotels, the Department of Defense, which I hear there's a lot of porn in the military, Hilton Worldwide, Google, Verizon, and then also billboards as well. So
and it's
how do you deal with that with your teen population that you're counseling?
So the beautiful part about this is, again, parents are the key. Parents are the key in these situations because you're right. Media is throwing out there. I mean, how often do we watch a sex scene? Even if it's just a PG-13, there's no boobs, there's nothing, but they come together. Right. And it's like, I mean, that is something that can be done. However, when we see it over and over and over again, it becomes expected of these teenagers and of adults. I work with couples all the time. They're like, well, we don't come together and we're supposed to. And it's like, well, we need to work on how that happens. And the movies don't show that.
Right.
There's so many jokes about having a long penis and it's so male pleasure centered. Everything is all about the man being seeking their pleasure and the women holding off and holding back. And it teaches us so many different things about how we're supposed to be and react as a sexual being. And with parents, what parents can do is take that and dismantle it, question it. Have conversations with your kids. When you see something on the radio or you hear something, one of my favorite stories that goes through my head is one of my friends is driving in the car and the Weeknd song, I Can't Feel My Face, comes on.
Right.
And so her kids are like, I can't feel my face when I'm with you. And beautiful. I mean, without skipping a beat after the song, she asked, she's like, wow, that's real interesting. You know, every time I'm with your dad, I can totally feel my face. I can feel the majority of my body. Like, I like being with him. And I was like, I wonder why he can't feel his face. And they're like, I don't know. That's kind of interesting. It seems minute, but it's things like that. Being able to have a parent say, oh my gosh, it looked like they jumped into bed really, really quick. I mean, they've known each other for 2 hours. What do you guys think about that? And the kids can be like, oh, that was really quick. Or, oh, it seems like they love each other a lot. And you can have conversations. You can insert what your values are and work with them about, what your hopes are for them being a sexual being, because we're working with people that are going to become sexual being, well, are sexual beings that eventually are going to be having sex, and we want to have them having positive, healthy sexual interaction. And it's hard to do that when they're 12 or when they're 8 or when they're 17.
Oh no, I agree with you. I was saying, I didn't even know what that song meant. I probably sang it myself, and you know, and I've listened to it, and they played it in my sweat cycle classes, and I never even paid attention to what the words meant. So I think that's great. Like, I didn't even know it had to do with sex, but I guess.
And I don't know either, to tell you the truth. I just know that she questioned it. And that's why I like the questioning.
I do like the questioning, because it's probably right, because this is what we're seeing with all these songs. There are a lot of derogatory things, like against females or against normal sex, normal, healthy, romantic sex. And it's just, you know, kind of subliminal in a way that's trying to get into your subconscious mind and trying to program you, even though you don't even know it.
Yeah. And when we give out these feelings, or we give out these messages of men are supposed to stay hard all the time. Men are always supposed to want sex. Women are supposed to, like, whatever we see within the media, from, like you've said it perfectly, from music to videos, to articles, to Cosmopolitan,
right.
All of it needs to be dismantled a little bit, or being able to be taken apart and say, what is this really showing to us, and how do we do that? In the article you were talking about, I think one of my favorite things is that they, once the kids learned, and Al Vernacchio, a sex educator in Philadelphia, he talks about how once you start putting things in context, kids start really grasping that concept of, like, oh, this is interesting. So if they've seen pornography and you're like, what do you think this person's doing after the scene's filmed? Are they shopping? Are they going to pick up their kids from daycare? Are they going home to a sweetheart? What are they doing after and before these things? Because all these kids are seeing is these individuals on their screen that are there wanting sex all the time. Whereas the same as watching a TV show or a movie, all we get is that one context, and questioning that and saying, what do you think's going on? Being curious.
Exactly.
Parents can help a ton with that. And all of a sudden it's like, oh, this is a lot different than what it's being made out to be. And teens pick up on that pretty quick.
Right. Here's the one thing that people don't realize. Children are very smart human beings.
Oh yeah,
I get that all the time, and I think we as a society take that for granted, instead of sitting down and really teaching them and being open with them and asking them those questions. And it's very simple, you know, and it sounds very simple, instead of we demonize it. Oh my God, my kid is watching porn. So, well, why don't you start talking to them about it, and seeing that, and I can almost guarantee that they would stop. I mean, in my practice, and I mentioned this in the last podcast, I'm not seeing so many teens engaging in sexual activity as I used to, let's say, 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. And the research does say that too, that there are less teens engaging in sex at an earlier age. That's a good and a bad thing, a good and bad, I think, because they're experiencing those relationships much later, and so, which can maybe pose more problems or how to connect with someone. Mm-hmm. So that's the way I see it. They're not really connecting at an earlier age, and they do blame the internet, of course. And they noticed that there was a decline, which started after 2011. They noticed that decline, and they're like, what happened during that time? The smartphone came out, which is interesting.
Yeah, that is interesting. And going into this is where we start touching on values, because you know, some parents don't want their kids having sex before they're married. Some teenagers don't want to have sex before they're married or before they're in a committed relationship. And what's beautiful about that is there are so many ways to build connection, but that involves being vulnerable. And so being able to teach vulnerability is super important, and being vulnerable about talking about sex, that is a great way to demonstrate to your child how to be vulnerable. and how they can be vulnerable in discussions, in their emotions, in their physical contact, in consent, everything.
And I think that's an excellent point you put up, is being vulnerable. A lot of people have a lot of trouble being vulnerable, you know, being who they are, being their own identity. So, but I think that's a great point. So any closing remarks, Braxton?
So I think that when it comes down to the pornography, again, I want to reiterate that your child is not a sex or a porn addict. They may be dealing with a lot of different stressors, and they may need some supportive therapy. If they're trying to cope with something, if they might even just be curious, and it's super important for us to recognize what their curiosity is, and or they're just accidentally running across it, those three C's. Understanding that teens use pornography and masturbation for stress, boredom, curiosity, and parents, you are equipped to talk about this. You just need to start having these conversations in small increments. You don't need to know everything to have a huge sex talk. Just start talking about it. Small increments, like we were talking about the media. Do small things. And if you're not 100% sure, or if you feel embarrassed by saying penis or vagina, practice. Go in the mirror and say it to yourself 5 or 6 times, or talk to a friend that you've got and say, I have to practice this so that I can say vulva, or I can say this, or I can explain something the way I want to explain it. If we can get away from, again, like I said, I don't think pornography, I think it's inappropriate, especially for teenagers that need more sexual education. Not pornography is sexual education, but the more that we can move away from this is, you know, my child's a sex addict, the more we're going to find what really is underlying in the child's issues. The thing I find the most in my practice is that when someone comes in saying they're feeling out of control or they feel like a porn addict, and we start addressing the anxiety, the depression, the OCD, whatever they're experiencing, and addressing that, I've noticed that the pornography use goes down, and they start to address what it is, and they start to address what the real problem is, and then they get to go into choice. They're choosing, oh, I would like to use it sometimes. I don't want to use it at all. And they get to start to own what they want. That's some anecdotal research on my end for just what my experiences have been with teenagers and pornography. But you can do this. As a parent, you can do this.
Yes, I think that's an excellent point. So anything you'd like to promote, your Birds and Bees podcast, is it on iTunes?
Yes. Yeah. Birds and Bees podcast. And that's the name, Birds and Bees podcast. It's on iTunes, Stitcher. We're on Spotify now, which is awesome. So you can listen to it on Spotify. As for right now, I've got episode 17 about eating disorders coming out today, I believe. Excellent. And I would recommend, if you're trying to learn more about how to talk to your teenagers or kids about sex, couple of books that are really great. Help Your Kids with Adolescence is a wonderful book. Covers a lot of different topics. For Goodness Sex by Al Vernacchio is wonderful for teens in talking about sex. That's a must read. Yeah, I would say that if you listen also in on our Birds and Bees podcast, the main goal is so that you can feel prepared to talk to your kids and your partner about healthy sexuality or sexual health and what you want your sexual health to look like. And I'd love to have you guys listen, and I'd love to be able to take some of the questions that you guys have as well. I think this is great.
Good. And your website is birdsandbeespodcast.com?
Yep, birdsandbeespodcast.com.
Excellent. And people can get a hold of you there if they have any questions, correct?
Yeah. Yes. And if you're curious about the three C's, I go more in depth in it with the three C's Facebook Live that I did. And you can go on Birds and Bees or facebook.com/birdsandbeespodcast, and I've got that video up there.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much, Braxton. This was a great discussion.
Yeah.
Very informative, lots of information. And nurses can get one continuing education unit for listening. Just go to the link on iTunes, click on the link and go to SurveyMonkey, fill out the survey, and you get your certificate for one continuing education unit for listening to this podcast. Also, if you like this podcast, please, please, please go on iTunes and give us a rating. Give us a rating. Give us a comment. We're on Instagram as Rogue Nurse Media, and we're on Facebook as Nurses and Hypochondriacs. And also, go to my GoFundMe page. Please, please, please. I am putting this together. I love to promote people like Braxton and all my artists and actors and comedians and activists who come on this program, as well as the nurses who are doing groundbreaking research to bring this information to you that you might not be able to get anywhere else. I mean, we're living in this very fast information technology world. Stuff is coming at us, you know. And I am trying to bring you guys the best, the most exciting and educational and also funny information out there to get you educated. So please go to my GoFundMe page, Nurses and Hypochondriacs. Thank you guys so much for listening. I appreciate all your comments. You guys are awesome. Take care until next time. Bye-bye.
Bye.